Sounds True presents Insight Meditation, Tape 5, a talk on concepts and reality with Joseph Goldstein.
Vipassana is a word in the Pali language which literally means seeing clearly. It means seeing clearly the specific elements of our experience in the body, in the mind. For example, understanding the nature of the breath or of sensations in the body, or of different mind elements like thoughts or emotions. Seeing clearly the nature of the hindrances, which Sharon and I have talked about previously. It also means seeing clearly the general characteristics or the universal qualities, like impermanence, like unreliability, like the selfless nature of all our experience. This selflessness is the most difficult to see and to realize. In some ways, it's the most puzzling aspect of the Buddhist teachings. If there's no self, who is it that's listening to this talk? Who makes effort in practice? If there's no self, who's reborn? Who gets angry? Who feels desire? Who has memories? What does it mean to say there's no self? Sometimes people hear this and are afraid of this idea. Maybe they imagine that they'll suddenly disappear like in a magician's trick. The deep understanding of selflessness, in Pali the word is anatta, this is the great jewel of the Buddha's enlightenment, the great jewel of his teaching. There's a story from times of ancient Greece of a king who lived in Asia Minor. His name was King Gordias. And he devised a test for the great warriors of the time. He had created a very special knot, and he said that anyone who could untie the knot would become the ruler of a good part of Asia. And so many great warriors and kings came, and they tried to disentangle the knot, and no one was able to do it. As the story goes, Alexander the Great came to know of this. He went to King Gordias, looked at the knot, took out his sword, and sliced it in half. In some way, the understanding of selflessness is like that dramatic cutting through the very idea of ego, the very idea of self. In our meditation, what we do is begin to open to this very transformative way of understanding ourselves and understanding the world. As our observing power of mind gets stronger, and as the awareness is stabilized, we find that we're not who we thought ourselves to be. We're not the sensations in the body, we're not the thoughts, we're not the emotions, which come and go. None of these actually last long enough to be called self. We begin to see that the whole sense of I, the whole sense of self, is a mental construct. It's a fabrication of the mind. And when we even begin to get a glimpse of this, we find that it's a great relief. Imagine what it would be like if we really were each of the thoughts that come through our mind. It would be a great burden. Today I'd like to talk about how the mind creates this very deeply conditioned idea of self, and how we can free ourselves from this illusion. What is the mind? The mind in its nature is the faculty of cognizance, of knowing. Where is it? What is it? Can we find it when we look for it? When we look for the mind, we find that it's invisible, it's clear, it's unobstructed, It's empty. It's naturally pure. The nature of mind is simply the knowing faculty. Knowing sight, knowing sound, knowing smell, knowing thought. If we were a corpse, the ear would still be there. The sound would still be there, but there would be no knowing. Mind is that element of consciousness which simply knows. And when we look carefully, when we investigate it carefully, we see that it's an everyday profound mystery. The nature of awareness. But the mind is also more than just knowing. In each moment of experience, different qualities or different what are called mental factors can arise and color the consciousness in different ways. So, for example, greed or hatred or love or mindfulness, concentration, compassion, despair, joy. All of these are mental factors, mental qualities which arise functioning in their own way and color the mind through their particular function. Some are wholesome, which means that they bring us happiness. Some are unwholesome, which means that they cause suffering. So there's the natural purity and clarity of consciousness, of knowing, and then this whole variety of mental factors, each arising and passing away in every moment. There's one particular factor of mind which, when out of balance, keeps us imprisoned in the conventional idea of self. And this is the factor which is called perception. The function of perception is to recognize objects. It's the function of recognition. That is, it picks out the distinguishing marks of different experiences, creates concepts from that recognition, and then stores it in our memory. So, for example, we hear a sound and we think bird or car or truck. That concept of bird or car or truck is arising out of our perception of that sound. We recognize the quality of the sound, we name it in a particular way, we create that concept, and then we store it in the memory. There are endless, innumerable examples of this. It's happening all the time in our lives, this process of recognition, recognizing man or woman, different colors, everything in our world. When there's perception, or this quality of recognition, along with mindfulness, the surface recognition frames the object for a deeper and more careful observation. And this really is the whole technique of mental noting. The mental note is not mindfulness. The mental note is perception, which is recognizing the object, in the service of mindfulness. We frame the experience with the note, and then we look more deeply. But when there's strong perception without mindfulness, what happens is that we know and remember only the surface appearance of things, and we solidify that superficial understanding with the concepts that we're creating. For example, we see this clearly with people that we meet and we know. We meet somebody, we recognize them, immediately the mind creates different concepts about them based on our past experience, based on our memory. We see this very clearly with the people that we meet and recognize. We have different concepts about them based on our memory, based on our past experience. We create concepts about these people, and then our experience becomes limited by these concepts which we're carrying. It's very difficult to stay open, to stay fresh, to stay with beginner's mind. We do this with our perception of others. We do this with our perception of ourselves. The same with any repetitive experience. We settle for a surface perception that surface recognition, and then we don't see deeply. This is a tremendous limitation on our ability to see and understand things in different ways. There's a story which illustrates this, which is really quite touching. It has been to me. I had a friend who had a young son and was in the first or second grade, maybe 6 or 7 years old, and the teacher asked the class, what color are apples? And most of the children in the class said, red or yellow, golden, green. The son of my friend raised his hand and he said, white. And the teacher kind of looked surprised and she said, there are no white apples. You must be thinking of something else. No, they are red and there's gold and green apples, but they're no white apples. But the young boy was very insistent. He said, no, apples are white. And the teacher got a little firm after a while and said, no, that's not correct. So finally the little boy said, well, when you cut the apple open, what color is it inside? And of course, when you open the apple, it's white. The child had a very wonderful sense of openness to the world around him, and so could see things in perhaps non-conventional ways. He wasn't trapped by the habit of perception. When we don't observe carefully, there's one deeply habituated perception we have about the world and about ourselves, which becomes the origin of many inaccurate conclusions. It's really a perception of the world which keeps us from the understanding of what's true. And that is the perception we have of the solidity of things. As long as the perception of solidity is there, we don't deeply understand impermanence or the insubstantial nature of momentary phenomena. Why do we have this idea of solidity? Why is it so strongly conditioned in our view of how things are? One reason is because of the rapidity of change. Things are changing so rapidly that they appear to be solid or continuous. Just a simple example of this, we go to the movies. We don't really see the true nature of what's happening in terms of separate frames of film moving very quickly in front of light, casting images on the screen. What we see is a continuous flow of image, and even more than that, we get very lost in the story of it, which is, of course, the whole point of going to the movies. It's the rapidity of change which obscures the reality of what's happening. Or we can see it with a current of electricity, creating an electric light. We don't see the fact that it's actually a current of change. What we see is a solid, continuous experience of light appearing. So the rapidity of change is one reason that we do perceive things as being solid or continuous. The other reason that prevents us from seeing the true nature of experience is that we usually observe things from a distance. By not observing closely, we don't see the composite nature of things in the world. For example, we put something apparently solid under a high-powered microscope. All of a sudden, there would be a whole different reality emerging, and what appeared to be so solid would be seen to be a mass of changing elements. As an experiment, look around at something in the distance. Perhaps there are trees in the distance, or a mountain, or a field, or another house. Look in the distance and notice what it is that you see. Maybe a mass of color. And then if you look more closely, you come a little closer, you might recognize the individual trees, which actually make up that mass of color. And come even closer, begin to see the parts of trees. The closer you come in your observation of the phenomena, the concept of tree will disappear. The notion of tree has disappeared. And it's the same with all other solid objects in our world. our bodies, car, house, tree, buildings. When the perception is stronger than the mindfulness, what happens is we see and recognize the general appearance and then take that concept of car, house, body to be a thing existing in itself. How much of our sense of ourselves comes from the concept we have of the body? Very often, it's the first and most immediate response to the question, who am I? We wake up in the morning, we look in the mirror, see the reflection of the body. Yep, that's me. That familiar recognition of who we are. But I had a friend who went through an interesting experience in surgery. She had laser surgery to remove a fibroid tumor. And it's quite amazing, the technology, the medical technology of how this is done. They make a very small incision in the body and go in with this very tiny scalpel with some kind of little video camera attached to it. So the surgeon is actually watching the video screen as they're cutting away the tumor. One of the rewards of going through the ordeal of the surgery is that when you leave the hospital, you're given a video of the operation. And it is really quite fantastic because we're able to see the inside of the body as the surgeon is performing the operation. And so we begin to see all the organs and the blood and the muscle and the tissues and all that stuff. In looking at that video and seeing the body from the inside, there was much less identification with blood and organs and muscle and tissue as being I or self than there is when it's all nice, neatly packaged in skin. The usefulness of the meditation is that we begin to see different levels of reality of our experience and not settle for a simple surface perception, surface recognition of how things are. We can see this also in the walking meditation. As you're paying attention carefully to the feeling of the movement, to the sensations in the movement, we can go in our experience from the concept of foot or leg or body. We can go from the image of the form to the direct experience of momentary changing sensations and see that the form, the notion of foot or leg, is simply a mental construct. It's a mental fabrication. And at a certain point in practice, the concept and form of foot or leg disappears. All of this does not mean that we don't see or use the whole, the concept, the form, but rather we see our experience to be a relationship of parts, not things existing in themselves. The concept of body is a useful concept. So we're not suggesting to throw out that idea or to throw out that notion. When we have the concept of body, we can buy clothes that fit us. We can know that a chair is mostly empty space. If we looked at it through a high-power microscope, we'd see that the apparent solidity is not true on that level. And at the same time, we come into a room and sit on it. And so it's an appreciation of different levels of understanding. The problem arises when we get attached or identified to the superficial level of perception. For example, if we're very identified with the concept of body, it has very great implications because it leads to attachment to one's own body, to other people's bodies, with the attendant fear of loss, fear of death. Our practice is to use concepts when appropriate, but to understand that what we call body, or what we call these various apparently solid things, are not solid and not static, but really exist as an energy field. In our meditation practice and in our awareness of the body, this energy field becomes increasingly refined. And sometimes in meditation, our perception of the body can disappear entirely. We've talked about concepts for the ordinary things in our lives. You know, the body, or cars, or trees, or people. There are other concepts which we create out of the surface perception of mental events. And some of them have enormous consequences in our lives. As a few examples, we've created a concept of time, created the concept of past and future. But when we look more carefully, what is the past? What is the future? We're sitting, perhaps feeling the breath, and certain thoughts arise, thoughts that are recollections or memories or remembrances. We see these thoughts, we put them in a certain category, we put a label on that category, we call it past, and then somehow with some clever mental gymnastic, it's as if we take that category which we've created, past, and toss it back behind us as if the past is a reality back there from which we've come. And yet when we look more carefully, we see that all that has actually happened is that there have been certain thoughts or images arising in the present moment. We do the same thing with future. We're sitting, minding our own business, different thoughts come of planning, imagining, anticipating. We create a category for these thoughts, we give a label to it, future, and then toss it out ahead of us as if the future is a reality out there, which is waiting for us. When we don't see that our experience of past and future is simply thoughts arising in the present moment, these concepts that we've created of time become a dominating force in our lives. How much of our day is spent dwelling in these thoughts of past? How much of our time is spent dwelling in thoughts of future? Because we're taking it to be a reality that it isn't. We're not seeing that they're simply thoughts arising right now in the moment. The Buddha talked of different dangers to concentration. And one of the dangers that he talked about for the development of deepening concentration is our identification with these concepts of past and future. How much of the time are we imprisoned in these mind worlds created by these concepts? Another concept which we create in our minds is that of ownership or possessiveness. We have the idea that we own things or possess things, whether it's other people, whether it's our own bodies, whether it's different aspects of our mind experience. There's a nice story by Mark Twain illustrating the conceptual nature of ownership. It's a story of some horse traders in Russia and the various things they get involved in, but the whole story is told from the horse's point of view. And from the horse's point of view, they're not owned. They're in relationship to various people. Some are kind and thoughtful, some are cruel. But in all of the situations of the story, not once do they think of themselves being owned. This is a concept which we're overlaying onto certain aspects of our experience. And it's very powerful, it's very deeply conditioned. Sometimes on retreat situation, I ask people to imagine what it would be like if they came into a meditation hall and somebody else was sitting on their cushion. it would be a mild traumatic event or a major traumatic event, because we have so much deeply conditioned sense of possessiveness. There's also the concept of self-images, our roles in the world, how we present ourselves to each other, how we present ourselves to ourselves. As soon as we identify with any role or self-image, it's already a contraction. We're already imprisoning ourselves in that idea. There's one story which illustrates this identification with role quite clearly. I'd been living in India and practicing for some time and was getting ready to return to America. But because I had been there for an extended period, I needed to get a special form, a tax form, saying that I had not worked and didn't owe the Indian government any money. Having been in India for a long time, I thought that I knew what to expect in going to the office, that there would be some delays. So I go into this tax office and I ask the person for the form, and he says, "Please wait." Okay, I was prepared for that, and I sit down and I'm watching my breath, rising, falling, and a half an hour, 45 minutes go by. Finally, I go up to the desk and I say, "Well, what am I waiting for?" He said, "Well, the forms are locked in the cabinet, you know, behind me." Okay, I go back and I sit for a little bit more, and then I have a brainstorm, as often happens in meditation. So I go back to the desk and I say, "Well, where's the key?" And the man says, "Well, the key's in the desk." And I look at him with a little surprise, and I said, "Well, why don't you take the key, open the cabinet, and give me the form?" And he looked at me with a totally straight face, and he said, "It's not my job." And I thought, well, this is a very strong identification with role, with self-image, and it's an obvious limitation in how we operate in the world. This is an extreme example, but we all do it to some extent or another. We get identified with our role of parent or child or teacher or student or employer or employee. There are many, many roles which we assume in our lives. We identify with things which may seem even more fundamental than these roles. We may get very identified with notion of race or gender or culture. But when we look more carefully and examine more deeply, what color is your mind? What gender is your breath? When you sit and are watching the breath, is the sensation of the breath male or female? It's not to say that these differences don't exist, that they're not there, because we're all living out a particular set of conditions and circumstances. It's a question of how strongly we become identified with these particular circumstances and take them to be who we are. As soon as we become identified with any arising condition, in that moment, we've created a separation. We've created the separation of self and other. We've created a prison of ego. The most deeply rooted concept, the Gordian knot of our lives, is the concept, or the fabrication, the mental fabrication of I, of self. The idea of there being someone to whom experience is happening. We create a reference point for all experience, and we call that mental reference point, that mental creation, self. The great awakening happens when we understand that all experience is empty phenomena rolling on. One of my teachers used that phrase early on in my practice, and it reverberated for me throughout my practice, empty phenomena rolling on. Empty in the sense empty of self. No one behind experience to whom the experience is happening. Everything is arising out of conditions. So why is this sense of self so strongly conditioned in us? If we go up to anybody on the street and say, "Do you exist?" Most people will have a very strong sense, yes, there's an I, there's a self, it exists. Why is it so strongly conditioned if it's not true, if it's simply a mental construct? The reason that this concept is so strongly conditioned, habituated in us, one reason is that we don't examine carefully this composite nature. We don't see that what we're calling self is a constellation of changing experience. It's a constellation of changing elements, elements of body, elements of mind. And each one of these elements is also momentary and insubstantial. We get so fixed on the idea of self as a thing existing independently because we rely on our superficial perception of recognition. As an experiment, go out some evening on a clear night, look up at the night sky, and see if you recognize the constellation the Big Dipper. This constellation is quite familiar to most of us. And then hold this question in mind. Is there a Big Dipper up in the sky? And intellectually we might respond, "Oh, I know that there's no Big Dipper." But then try to go outside at night, look up at the sky, and not see the Big Dipper. It's very difficult. The concept has been so strongly conditioned in us that it's very difficult to see the reality of the night sky free of the concept. And what does that concept do? It separates out that particular constellation from all the other constellations in the sky, from all the other stars. And so it creates this division, this separation that is not inherently there. The separation is being caused by our attachment to the concept. This is not to say that we throw out this concept. It's useful for people navigating on the ocean. In the old days, they would use the Big Dipper to locate the North Star. So concepts are useful in our lives. It's simply that we need to understand that they are constructs of our mind and don't refer to a reality existing in themselves. As our practice continues through sustained interest and the development of concentration and attentiveness, we begin to see and feel all of these changing elements of experience without creating the concept of self. There's one very succinct teaching of the Buddha which expresses this. There was one person who had heard of the Buddha and wanted very much to get the teachings. And he traveled all the way across India and finally met up with the Buddha in this town. But at that time when he arrived, the Buddha was out on alms round, collecting food. So this man looked for him in the town and found him. And right in the middle of the street he said, "Please teach me. You know, I want to understand." And the Buddha replied, "Well, wait till we finish collecting the alms food. We'll go back, have lunch. Then I'll give you the teachings." But this man was very insistent. He had some compelling urgency in his spirit. So he said, "Please teach me now." And he asked the second time, asked the third time. Finally, the Buddha agreed. But what to say? How to encapsulate the profound meaning of the Dharma in just a few sentences? So this is what the Buddha said. And to jump ahead for a moment in the story, the man heard this teaching and right there, standing in the street, got enlightened. The Buddha said, "In the seen, that is seen with the eyes, there is just what is seen. In the heard, there is just what is heard. In the sensed, that is smell and taste and touch, there is just what is sensed. In the thought, there is just what is thought." in the seen, just what is seen, in the heard, just what is heard, in the sensed, just what is sensed, in the thought, just what is thought. That is all. This brings us right into the moment of direct experience of exactly what is happening, without the creation of any extra concept, any extra mental construct. We begin to live in our experience free of the addiction of I, of self, of mine. There's a famous Tibetan meditation master. His name is Kalu Rinpoche. And I'd like to close with one of his teachings, which sums all of this up. He said, we live in illusion and the appearance of things. We live in the world of concepts. There is a reality. We are that reality. When we understand this, we see we are nothing. And being nothing, we are everything. That is all. We live in illusion and the appearance of things. There is a reality. We are that reality. Understanding this, we see that we are nothing. And being nothing, we are everything. That is all.